If you think you can't go from politics to the divine, Carol Gold and Steve Clark are about to take you above the fray. The only agenda here is to empower you to think for yourself, ask more questions, and trust your own truth. So now, the combination talk radio has been missing. Until now, Carol Gold and Steve Clark taking you above the fray.
Hi, I'm Carol Gold, and welcome to Above the Fray. Our number here is 914-803-4522. Your calls are welcome. We'll gladly put you on air, hear your opinion, and share your comments with us. I'm here, as usual, with my interesting and learned co-host, Steve Clark. Hi, Steve.
Good evening, Carol.
And what we want to talk about, Steve, before we get into the Pope's speech today, was it today, right?
Correct.
Before we get there, before his speech before Congress, let's tidy up what we only got a few minutes for on the last show, and that was both the escalating suicide rate among veterans from in the military currently, meaning currently escalating suicide rate, and the really somewhat appalling reality as to situations that our soldiers are being told to stand down in Afghanistan. So let's first look at that suicide situation. There was an article, I believe it was in the New York Times over the weekend, and it detailed an extraordinary amount of suicides within one unit that it went into not only the conditions that kind of the conditions of war that they experienced in Afghanistan and their interactions with the local population, but also sort of the mentality and the mindset and the psychological health or illness that they came home with, and the failure of the VA to address it properly, to provide them with the most basic and adequate psychological and psychiatric and in some cases medical care. So Steve, as a former Marine, can you tell me your thoughts around kind of what when a soldier comes home from a war zone, can you kind of talk a little bit about the need to sort of emerge yourself or readjust to your home, your environment, just the different culture back where you came from, and the kind of support systems that are necessary in order to make that effective for most men and women. Steve, I have no sound from you. Are you there?
How about
Steve?
Now?
Go ahead, try again.
You
sound very far away.
How about now?
Better. Go ahead. You're on.
So I'll address it through a book that I read a while back. It came out about a year ago. It's called Thank You for Serving. And the book just is really insightful because it entails about 15 different stories from different units. It takes different services, different VA hospitals, different circumstances, different injuries. In the book, they detailed some people who had just suffered from PTSD just from the traumas of war. Other people had affected issues such as loss of life in their units. Some people had dealt with some other physical injuries. And it went at great lengths to discuss the failures of the VA. Number one, The thing that I found was interesting is that most of the population that goes into the military, there's a lot of them that's kind of a small town feel to it. A lot of these people come from not all the time, somewhat limited backgrounds and limited exposure to the world at large. And they get thrust into the situations, and they're coming back with some very serious injuries and serious things that they need to deal with. And the book was really just a series of failures from the military standpoint, from the unit standpoint, from the support groups, from the VA side, and it really, you know, it really is enlightening to see that we're very competent and capable as a military to send people to war, but we're not very competent and capable actually, you know, bringing people back from war and integrating them, you know, back into society. In my experience, you know, the big thing that happened after the first Gulf War was less so on the injury side, but much more, I don't know if you remember this, the cases where people came back with what was called Gulf War Syndrome. And
yes, I do.
And I personally believe it was a response from that everybody that went over there had to take a series of drugs before they went over there. The desert was full of, you know, basic, you know, dead animals, dead flies, a lot of different things that most Americans aren't exposed to. And then you had a series of chemical attacks through the chemical mines in many places around Kuwait and in Iraq that, you know, I personally experienced one. And it affected people that had some, you know, very serious injuries after the war. And there was a whole scandal with even with them that the resources weren't available to help them. Having been in the Marines, and I'm married to somebody from Ecuador, and it's really fascinating to talk to her because she'll ask me, and she says, so what do you get now that you were in the Marines and you served in the war and then you fought for your country? What do you get? And I always tell her, you get nothing. And she says, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would anybody join the military if they get nothing? You mean you served in a war and you actually fought on the battlefield? And you risked your life and you get nothing today? And I said, I get absolutely nothing today. And on one side, you know, it's an interesting perspective from a foreigner to have you ask that question. Because when you answer it, it does sound a little bit ridiculous that I'm not looking for anything, but there's got to be some support system or some functional way to help our veterans coming back. And the reality is there really isn't. In the pathetic attempts that the administration has done, not just Obama, but the administrations previously, there's never been a really good functioning VA to treat our veterans.
Well, yeah, there is an organization. There is an organization. It's called the Veterans Administration, but it does a poor job, admittedly. You know, I'm reminded. I had a personal experience when I was in law school. There was something called free legal aid for the mentally ill at a Haverford State Mental Hospital, which was in Pennsylvania, and it was a state-funded, just like it sounded, Haverford State Mental Hospital. And it was before a lot of the mental hospitals were closed across this country, and people with mental disorders were summarily dismissed and put out on the street, which is where a whole homeless problem came from. But putting that aside, I was part of that program, free legal aid for the mentally ill, and we had offices in the basement of the hospital. And so what we were there to do was to provide what it sounded like, free legal aid, when there were patients who needed legal issues addressed. So one of the most startling things that I experienced there was that every inpatient had to have a certain amount of hours per week seen by an in-house psychiatrist. And the psychiatrists were hired by the state. The problem was that most of the psychiatrists hired were foreign educated and didn't speak English. They didn't speak English. So you had mentally ill people who had mandatory sessions with a psychiatrist who didn't speak their language. But they were fulfilling the requirement that patient sat X amount of minutes per week with the in-house psychiatrist, because that was part of the funding criteria that had to be met in order for state and federal funds to continue to come to the facility. So to me, I wasn't surprised when I read the article in the New York Times about some of the egregious things that happen to soldiers who come back and go to the VA for psychiatric support. When I read one of the stories that a veteran from this particular unit that the article focused on had given up on the VA twice. But when the latest suicide took place in his unit, he felt completely devastated, and so he went back to the VA for a third time. And he was assigned a psychiatrist, a woman, and when he met with her the first time, he opened up and told her about what he had seen when he himself had failed to identify an improvised explosive device that had been in front of their tank. And it was his job to find them, and he generally did, but he missed this one. It blew up. There was a lot of injuries. His superior was killed. Others were maimed. And he had carried this guilt with him. And also of the many losses that had already taken place from his unit through suicide since they were back. And her response to him was, the VA psychiatrist's response to him was, that he should treat all of those dead comrades like as if he had been in a relationship with a woman and she broke it off. He should treat it as, okay, it was a loss, but now I've got to get on with it. And of course, he walked out of the room. It was the most absurd. It wasn't even a common sense response, let alone a directive coming from a treating physician. So when I heard it, it reminded me of what happened at Haverford State with non-English speaking psychiatrists. Because I think that the VA is in many ways an indication of how poorly sometimes large governments administer organizations. Now, it's not always the case. I mean, Medicare is pretty effective and well-run. There may be a lot of fraud and greed and everything else and waste, but if you're on Medicare, and that is a government, large bureaucratic entity, Medicare works pretty well. So it can be done. It just isn't being done with the VA, and I find it incredibly tragic. Steve, I don't want to short our listeners on the Pope's speech, so let's just spend a minute or two, or maybe 3 or 4 minutes, on the other article from that we referenced in our last show on Tuesday, and that was our soldiers being told to stand down when they encounter sexually abusive little boys in Afghanistan. The reason they're being told to stand down is that it is cultural. The difference is cultural. And because we want to get along with these people, we need not to interfere. I heard two absolutely, I mean, not that you need stories, but the two that really knocked me over are, one, two of our soldiers were discharged for intervening where a Afghani officer had kidnapped a little boy, chained him to his bed in his barrack, and was sexually abusing him multiple times a day. The mother came to try to rescue the son. She was beaten. She managed to get away with him. She came to the U.S. Army base to ask for help and for protection. The two soldiers that were in the article went and got the Afghani officer, brought him in, discussed with him what had happened. He laughed in their face, so one of our soldiers punched him around a bit and told him that was nothing compared to what would happen if he bothered the boy or the mother again or kept up with this behavior. And a week later, the two soldiers were discharged. Their tour was over, and they were sent home. One of them left the Army voluntarily. The other one is actually still active, but he's got a court-martial appeal. Maybe it's not a court-martial. He's got an appeal that he's filed for what was written in their record as to why they were brought home from Iraq. The other example is an Afghani officer who raped a young girl, and the American soldiers found out about it. They reported him. He was brought before a local court. He got a day in jail. And then the girl, because she was no longer a virgin and therefore used property and no one could marry her, was given the choice of death or to marry the rapist. So she chose to marry him rather than die. So she's now married to her rapist, and he served a day in jail, and we're told to stay out of it. There's something very sick going on from the top of the military down. I don't believe these young men and women who go over there have ill intent. I believe they're almost to a man or to a woman, decent American citizens raised with pretty decent values. But somehow at the administrative level, bad decisions are being made about what our role is in the world. And I think it transcends military service. If you have a conscience that says it's wrong to rape little boys and you're watching it happen and someone tells you to turn away and do nothing, I think you're in the right if you do something and intervene.
Well, Carol, I think you're spot on. I think what happens, most people don't realize that the military, the wars that are fought, are really fought with the young people. And they're fought, if people don't have a context of how the military works, essentially your 18 to 22-year-olds are basically the people on the ground. Those are your privates to your corporals, and your 22 to 30-year-olds are your, corporals to sergeants, and then higher up you have your senior NCOs. In the officer ranks, it's really fought, between lieutenants and captains, and, their average age is probably around 27, 28, and they do the bulk of the fighting, and they do all the heavy lifting. It's just always been the nature of war that way, and I would call the higher ranks, they tend to see less of it, and so there becomes a disconnect, like you said, where you'll see these incidences, and they report them up the chain of command, and the chain of command is less in touch with what's happening, and they don't really understand. I'll give you a perfect example. In the Marine Corps, I was with a guy in Kuwait, and there was an incident after the first Gulf War where they had to the units had to stand down. Essentially, there was a ceasefire that was taking place, and what happened is that Saddam essentially hoodwinked the U.S. They were allowed to continue to fight the Kurds because there was an insurrection, and the Kurds had felt that the U.S. would back them. Well, that ceasefire and that treaty forbade from the U.S. from actually engaging. And so there was a movie that was actually made out of this over this with George Clooney. I think it was called Three Kings. But a friend of mine was in an incident similar to that. He was a lieutenant. He was stationed, somewhere in Iraq, and he saw Iraqis killing Kurdish women and children. And he engaged with the Iraqis, and he stopped the slaughter, and he got into a lot of trouble because he had violated the terms of the ceasefire. When I talked to him, his point was that how can I just stand there and see innocent people get slaughtered? I couldn't do that, so I was willing to violate the ceasefire, and he actually got into a lot of trouble. He didn't go to jail, and he ended up being fined, but those are the types of decisions that get made in people that people in the predicaments. And unfortunately, the press has a hard time reporting these stories because they don't understand the conflicts between the people who are actually seeing these tragedies on the ground and the people, the administrators that are three or four steps removed and are making these decisions. And it puts these poor kids in really, really bad positions.
Yeah, I went to law school twice. The first time I was 27 years old, and I lasted 6 weeks because I heard things from the dean and from one of the professors that was so skewed about what a lawyer should be and what the ethics should be that I left law school, moved back across the country from Los Angeles where I had moved, and didn't go to law school again for 5 more years. And when people asked me why I dropped out after 6 weeks, I said, because I knew I was going to be a great lawyer, but I also knew I was going to turn out to be a terrible human being because I didn't know enough of who I was yet before I was going to let them give me values. And so it's like that. It's the young men, those age brackets that you spoke about, Steve, that go and fight these wars. And a lot of times they're still forming who they are and don't always have the courage of their convictions or to speak up because they're still young and not aware yet of how much they don't know. Steve, I'm going to segue here. We've got less than 10 minutes, and we did promote the Pope's speech. I read it. I didn't watch it. I assume you either read it or watched it. Am I right?
Yes, I have.
So because we have 10 minutes, Steve, and because, no pun intended, let me play devil's advocate, because you're the Catholic and I'm not, I have some questions. Number one, my understanding is that the Pope is a Jesuit. And by the way, I'm gonna kind of attack the speech before maybe we won't even have time to get to the good parts. But let me say, my understanding is that he's a Jesuit. My understanding of that he is a Jesuit. It's not my understanding. He is. My understanding of the Jesuits is that they are basically the socialist slash communist wing of Catholicism, and he comes from South America as well, and so he's much more socialist leaning, I think, in his politics than he is on other matters, or at least in politics, he comes off as being socialist. So I read the speech and I thought there were a couple of things that jumped out at me. The first one was I saw virtually no reference to abortion. The second thing is, of the four people, the four Americans that he chose to highlight, Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, Dorothy Day, and Thomas Merton, Dorothy Day was a socialist. She was actually much more of a communist than a socialist. And she sort of promoted Catholicism as being almost indistinguishable from the application of socialism slash communism. So while I wasn't surprised in him that he would choose Dorothy Day as one of the four people, I can't believe that Pope John Paul would have chosen Dorothy Day. And in the context of not having spent any time at all on abortion, but talking about the quote, this is a quote, "If politics must truly be the service of the human person, it follows that it cannot be a slave to the economy and finance. Politics is instead an expression of our compelling need to live as one in order to build as one for the greatest good." And then he also goes on to talk about, it goes without saying that part of this great effort is the creation and distribution of wealth. So talk to me, Steve, about, I know the Pope is infallible on religious reasons, on spiritual matters, and that he's not on anything other than that. But doesn't it seems to me as a non-Catholic that when he gets an opportunity to speak to the largest governing body of the most powerful country in the world, and we just voted down the abortion ban, the 20-week abortion ban bill, it didn't pass, that he could have gotten on that bully pulpit and said, abortion is an abomination, and it flies in the face of Catholicism, and he would have changed the discussion about abortion in this country had he done that. And instead, he went down the road of Dorothy Day and political oneness. Can you help me out here? I'll let you have the rest of the 6 minutes if you need it.
I completely agree with your analysis. I want to go back with it's really important that our listeners understand that you're right. The point on the Jesuit thing is absolutely right. It is much more of what's called the left-leaning side of the church. And it's not only that, but in Latin America, because there is such wealth, such a wealth divide between the rich and the poor, there is no middle class. You either have money or you don't. And there's extreme poverty in many parts of Latin America, maybe the exception of Chile, which really, and Colombia, that have more of a middle class. But the rest of the countries, what happens is that from the common man, they can see that there really is a lot of injustices in the world, and capitalism hasn't solved it, because really what it is, it's a form of socialism and crony capitalism in Latin America, and it's all based on context. So there's really not fairness, and so I can completely understand that worldview and how it gets formed. With that being said, though, you're absolutely right. The Pope is addressing issues of a political.
We lost you, Steve. We lost you. Your connection is just not there. I assume you were going to say that the Pope is addressing issues of political, from a political perspective, rather than from a biblical / spiritual perspective. Oh, you're back. You're back now. We lost you. But you said.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I'll tell you where you let off. You let off where you were saying that the Pope is addressing matters from a political perspective.
Yeah, and it's not his point. He's a religious leader. He's not a political leader. And my point is that we live in a society where everything gets politicized today, and so both sides are going to latch onto points that address or further their causes, which I think is a complete missed opportunity. The questions of faith that he could have addressed is absolutely correct. The sanctity of life in all forms. He addressed it just briefly with his opposition to the death penalty, but the flip side of that is, you know, opposition to abortion. He could have addressed things of that nature, and I think he missed a big opportunity. And what he has done is he's interjected himself more from a political standpoint. I want to address, you know, one of his key things that he's been harping on, the immigration issue, and I understand the tragedy that's taken place, but I was looking at the numbers today. You know, the U.S. is a population of 300 million. Europe's a population of 500 million. The U.S., you know, has, I want to say, the numbers that I were reading today, has 45 million people that are foreign-born. Europe has 35 million. The U.S. is by far the leading country in the world for bringing in immigrants into their country. And so I find it distasteful that the Pope would address the issue of immigration when the U.S. has been, I would say, the leader in the world for immigration. What people are upset about today is illegal immigration, the breaking of laws to come into our country. And again, it gets to the matter of the Pope not addressing spiritual issues, but again using the bully pulpit to go after the U.S. for political. And that's where I would speak for many Catholics who I believe express that same sentiment.
Well, on the abortion issue, it shocked me because he talked about the most vulnerable among us, and who he addressed. What he said after that is our youth. Well, our youth are not the most vulnerable among us. Our in utero are the most vulnerable among us. And so I thought that was a real, really bad way to I just thought it was, like you said, it was a missed opportunity. In terms of immigration, you're absolutely right. We are the most open country. We take in the most foreign-born. And to come and lecture us or make us sound like that's an issue that we need to address, when in fact you made that distinction. Our problem today isn't immigration, it's illegal immigration, and there's a big difference between the two. So I felt that the speech was weak and politicized from the Pope's standpoint, not just from the interpretation of media or left or right in this country. I feel he politicized the speech, and I thought I was greatly, greatly disappointed. I think the entire visit was an opportunity lost. So we're down to about a minute. We want to thank you, as always, for joining us here at Above the Fray Podcast. We'll be back again next Monday at 6 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Eastern. Spread the word. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Blog Talk Radio. We welcome not only you at this show, but we welcome anyone who joins the show, because you've spread the word that this is a place where you can get both inspiration and an education at the same time. I'm Carol Gold.
I'm Steve Clark.
And you've been listening to Above the Fray Podcast. Have a great weekend, everyone.
You've been listening to Above the Fray with Carol Gold and Steve Clark, from politics to the divine. Thanks for being a part of a new way to see the world. Visit our website at AboveTheFrayPodcast.com and like us on our Facebook fan page, Facebook.com/AboveTheFrayPodcast. This has been Carol Gold and Steve Clark, taking you always above the fray.